Welcome to The Disaster Project, a podcast about everything disaster. I'm your host, Dr. Larissa Unruh. Let's talk about a topic that until recently was considered taboo for medical providers to admit to experiencing. Mental health issues such as depression, anxiety, and the moral injury that comes from experiencing the suffering in those around you. No matter who you are, experiencing human suffering either in yourself or those around you takes a toll. And while it impacts different people in different ways, those experiences are always there in the background, waiting to be recalled at sometimes inopportune moments. This is something that professionals such as first responders, disaster responders, and medical professionals of all types should be fully aware of, because these are the people who, for whatever reason, have found it within themselves a desire to seek out human suffering and try to help. But what is a responder or a medical professional's actual commitment? As a medical provider, do you have a duty to respond? What about a tech in the ED or a resident? Do you have a duty to put yourself or your family at risk of physical or mental harm? Well, those issues are the topics of today's episode. Meet Dr. Tom Kirsch, a self-proclaimed disaster curmudgeon who, in addition to being the former director of the National Center for Disaster Medicine and Public Health, has spent his time learning from his experiences as a DMAT responder and bringing awareness to responder mental health issues, issues around the so-called duty to treat, and around moral injury. He's an author, published in everything from the New England Journal of Medicine to The Atlantic, a researcher, a teacher, and a mentor, and I can't wait for you to hear what he has to say today. Welcome to The Disaster Project, Dr. Kirsch. So you've had a very effective career in disaster. Talk to me about how you got involved with this work and how your career evolved over the years.
Well, let's go way back. When I, you know, as a med student, I, like a lot of med students, wanted to save the world and do things globally and all that stuff, travel to exotic places. And so I looked all around during my medical school career to try to find a place I could work overseas in a disaster humanitarian setting. Finally found a place that was with Georgetown and Catholic Relief Services in Thailand, working with Cambodian refugees, which meant that I missed my med school graduation and worked through the summer before my internship. And that was kind of the deciding moment in my life, because I was going to go into general surgery, and instead I finished my internship and then quit and then went and got a master's in public health and then went and worked overseas for a couple of years before going back to residency. And I chose emergency medicine because I thought that skill set was the best in a global setting, because it's a diverse skill set working in a quasi-austere environment. So that's how I got there. Staying in a career related to disaster and humanitarian response is difficult for many reasons. The main one being there's this thing called love, and then you fall in love and you marry somebody and then you have children and then they screw everything up because it's hard to travel. And so I got married, I had kids, and I switched then from working globally to doing more domestic response. And for almost 15 years, focused mostly on domestic responses, so I didn't have to be away from home for months at a time. You know, it's challenging to have a career in humanitarian response and to maintain a family and to maintain a career, because, you know, you can't just take off from your shifts in the emergency department and go spend 3 months in Nepal. And so I worked in an academic setting so that I was working fewer clinical shifts and my research was focused on humanitarian stuff. And it was easier for me to swap out shifts so I could actually go work and do disaster response.
What kind of domestic response did you do?
Most of the famous ones in the early 2000s. I responded to 9/11 in New York City. I did Katrina, I did Harvey, I did a number of California wildfires, I did Hurricane Sandy. I guess those are the main ones. Between 2001 and 2016, I probably did 10 major responses.
What did you do on those responses?
So the lesson that I learned very early in my career is that being a clinician in a disaster response, at least being an American clinician in a disaster response, even a global setting, was pretty useless. Because frankly, there's usually a health system that already exists and is already providing care, and they speak the language and they know the population and all that other stuff. And so I switched early on to doing more public health response and organizing public health activities, and then also doing post-disaster research, looking for ways to improve disaster response. So most of my focus was not doing clinical work. The two exceptions were the Haiti earthquake in 2010. I did clinical work because the entire Haiti healthcare system collapsed and they needed outside doctors, and Cambodian response back in the late 80s.
So at what point during your involvement with medicine and disaster response did you actually start thinking about crisis and disaster ethics and moral injury? Was there an event that made you start thinking about it deeply, or did it just kind of evolve as you kept responding to these things?
When you, as a wealthy, privileged, you know, American, go respond to these disasters in global settings, and for the most part, around the world, you know, disasters always affect the poorest of the poor and the most marginalized society. And you start seeing the discrepancies and the gaps and the horrendous kind of moral issues, you know, it makes you start thinking quite a bit. The big crisis event for me that really made me focus on the moral injury thing was the Haiti response, where, again, I provided clinical care there. And because there was essentially no healthcare system, or not much of a healthcare system, maybe before the earthquake, and what there was entirely destroyed, it was just overwhelming the needs, and our resources, our ability to provide care was so limited that we had to make decisions to ration care. You know, this guy gets the antibiotics and this guy doesn't, and he dies. And so that was a crisis for me personally. And I suffered PTSD for years. And that really made me think about why, you know, why am I suffering and what's going on and why does this happen? And I started doing more and more reading and research and therapy and all those other good things. And then when other events occurred, and particularly when COVID hit, and we across the country in many locations were faced with both overwhelming need, you know, incredible stress and all the other bad things that go with that, I started writing both kind of popular essays as well as more scientific essays about the topic.
Can you explain a little bit more about what crisis standards of care are and what it means to have disaster ethics?
I've always been annoyed by the term crisis standards of care because they keep changing. It used to be emergency standards of care, I don't know what it was, because they basically don't want to use the term rationing healthcare, but that's what it is. In America, we don't ration healthcare other than economically, where people don't have insurance and so just don't access it. If you get to the healthcare system because of laws and because of ethical duties, you'll get a lot of care. It may bankrupt you, but you'll get all the care you have because we have unlimited resources to care for people. In a global setting, you get used to functioning in an environment where you don't have unlimited resources. And every day you make small decisions about ration care. Well, I just won't get a lab test on this person, or well, they won't get an x-ray, or little stuff like that. In the US, we aren't faced with that. So we're very protected and live in our little perfect cocoon. And when we are faced with a sudden situation, whether it's responding to a global situation like Haiti, or whether it's COVID, where suddenly our practice changes to having to make decisions that can negatively affect your patients, that's what causes moral distress. That's where you have a moral duty. We are taught as physicians that it is our duty, beneficence and non-malfeasance and all that, is always our duty to do what's best for the patient in front of us. Well, when you don't have enough resources and you aren't allowed to do that, that causes an ethical dilemma, and that's what moral stress is.
So just to summarize, crisis standards of care, even though you don't love the term, is essentially rationing, and it's essentially making decisions in limited resource situations about which patients get what. Is that correct, or did I miss anything?
Nope, that's correct.
Okay. So you did mention COVID. Do you think that during the early days of COVID, when there were like ventilator shortages, that we were actually practicing crisis standards of care in the U.S.?
Well, you know, it depends on the jurisdiction. Certain jurisdictions, particularly New York City, because they got hit with the first wave, clearly were, where the ventilator allocation issues came up big time. Most places in the country, metropolitan areas, reached a point where decisions had to be made to significantly alter how you provide care. Well, you know, we're going to not intubate this person for another few hours because there's no ventilators anyway. Or, well, you know, we're not sure if this person needs to be admitted because their oxygen saturation is only 87%. You know, every other day we'd admit that patient. And, you know, we'll give them some Paxlovid and send them home and see how they do. We were all forced to make atypical decisions that we wouldn't normally make, some of which were overtly a dilemma, like, well, we're just not going to intubate this person. They're probably going to die. And others which were more subtle, like, well, we'll just try the Paxlovid see how they do at home. So I do think a lot of healthcare workers were faced with altering their standards of care, altering what they would do on a daily basis.
During this time, the second years at my residency program, they had to do extra ICU rotations. So they spent probably like half their year in the ICU with just COVID patients. And a lot of them ended up with probably very light PTSD and probably moral injury. Can you describe what overall moral injury means and maybe personally what that means to you and how it relates to disaster and disaster response?
There are a lot of surveys done during COVID that showed increased rates of depression and anxiety in healthcare workers and stuff. And so I think many people suffered with that. You know, some of the numbers are as high as 50 or 60% of healthcare workers were suffering with significant depression and anxiety. The term moral injury is a specific event because of these moral dilemmas where you're forced to make choices that you consider immoral. It's not a psychologic diagnosis, it's what leads to depression and anxiety. The good news in all of those things is that most people afflicted with these situations will do fine. In any given disaster, only about 20% of the people will suffer PTSD or significant diagnosable effects of the event. And then of that 20% of the people, I think it's about 80% of them will get better within a year. And relatively few have long-term PTSD. And so we all, because of our moral dilemmas, had some sense of anxiety and depression, or not all, most of us. Most people didn't suffer long-term impacts from that, which is the good news. However, we're seeing even today, you know, we don't have enough staff because so many people quit, so many nurses and tech. In fact, if you look at it, it's really the nurses and techs that suffered the brunt of COVID. Most of the deaths in healthcare workers were among nurses and techs and not among physicians. And they suffered horrible schedules and all kinds of bad things. And they got paid, you know, their crappy $16 an hour or whatever, and still risk their lives. And so we've lost so many staff now. It's an issue just trying to keep our emergency departments open. It's an issue across the country.
You had mentioned that you personally, after going to Haiti, where you had to make some of these really hard decisions, you had PTSD. How were you able to combat that?
Well, first, I ignored it for a decade and I was just a jerk to everybody. Haiti was the breaking point. It was really the culmination of a lot of different disasters. I guess I don't deal well with human suffering, but I ignored it and my marriage fell apart. And then I started getting therapy and working on it. And so I'm not very bright when it comes to mental health care. And it took me a long time to get over it as a result.
I'm sure it wasn't just you, but I feel like thinking about mental health and PTSD is kind of more of a recent thing that people are now putting emphasis on because they're starting to realize just how important it is. Do you have suggestions about how to address it more upfront in people who are responding to some of these situations?
So for the moral dilemma thing about making decisions that are harmful to your patients, the thing we did in Haiti, because you know, you'd have a patient in front of you and they're sick and they're dying, and there was no bed to put them in. And there were another 40 people in our tent doing the same thing. And so we were forced with like just saying, oh, kicking them out and letting them die. So we learned early on that making decisions directly harming your own patient was not a smart thing to do, and it was horrible, and you couldn't sleep all night. And so we ad hoc formed a committee in our group of responders, nurses, and doctors. And we would meet to discuss who would get care. And so independently, we set up this objective group that took it out of the hands of the clinician providing care and let them make the decision. And since that time, there's been a lot of research in the last 20 years, which show that that's the way to do it. In fact, when COVID first hit, it first hit in northern Italy, if you remember, and then followed New York City a few weeks later. And then the Italian Association of Anesthesia and Critical Care wrote guidelines very early on in the response, which specifically said a hospital-based committee should be the one that makes decisions to ration care. And then most states in the U.S. or most metropolitan areas that form groups, like the state of Maryland, had a very specific set of guidelines that says these decisions should be made not by the provider, but by an independent objective committee. And I do think that's critically important in the moment during the response to prevent developing PTSD. You do not want to have the burden on your shoulders of harming or even killing your own patients. And so I think during the response, it's critical people do that, have these objective pathways and objective committees to make these morally stressful decisions. But then in the post-hoc phase where you're developing anxiety and stress, You need to seek care early. I'm not a psychologist. I know that the interventions, particularly for PTSD, have limited viability. There's one called EMDR that has some utility. But it is important to not be dumb like me and ignored for 10 years, and to seek care and to try to at least confront and acknowledge what you're going through to prevent long-term damage to yourself and others.
I know there's mixed feelings about debrief groups and forcing people to like talk about how they're feeling right after an event. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist, but my reading of the whole debrief thing, that was kind of a big fad for a number of years. And I personally find utility in it, but there's no evidence that I'm aware of that shows that there's any utility in preventing long-term mental health effects. And so I do think it's person dependent. And all of this is person dependent. Again, only about 20% of the people in a given disaster, both victims and responders, will end up having long-term PTSD. And so everyone's a little bit different in all the situations. And frankly, some people don't feel any moral dilemma. You know, they're comfortable with making decisions that a lot of us aren't comfortable with making. And so I do think it's very user dependent. The bottom line, though, is don't ignore it. You know, if you find yourself not sleeping or yelling at your wife or friends or putting on weight because you're eating too much or whatever it is, if there are signs in your life that things are going wrong, then you need to take control of it. I finally sat down personally and I did the PTSD. There's a checklist. I think there's 23 different variables to diagnose whether or not you have PTSD. And either you have to make, you know, 9 out of the 23 or something. And so I finally sat down and did the checklist myself and self-diagnosed myself. So don't ignore it.
You had mentioned these committees that make these decisions. Have you ever had to participate in a committee like that?
No, I haven't been on one.
Do you generally know how they make those decisions? Is it random, or what do they use to make that choice?
The best example I know is the state of Maryland. They had formal checklists. So one of the trouble with making these decisions is you have to avoid bias. And so you want to try to be objective. And so, you know, ideally you're going to use something like a SOFA score to determine probability of survival. But you also want to make sure you're not ageist and disablest and racist and whatever, all the different biases you can have. And so the committees, there's usually a formal tool or checklist. State of Maryland had a tool that they used to try to balance various neutral ethical factors to help make the decision. It often comes down to ties, though, and then you know, vote or whatever. But there are tools out there. There's quite a few. There's a lot of stuff developed during COVID, which went beyond just the simple crisis standards of care by the national academies that were very specific tools and decision-making methods for these kinds of settings that are quite useful. California had a good one. Maryland had a good one. A lot of the states had really good ones.
Do you think that moral injury is related to compassion fatigue? And does that affect then crisis standards of care and how that's carried out?
I haven't read enough to specifically say scientifically and logically that makes sense. You keep getting your morals injured and then you turn inward and are less compassionate. But I don't know that there's any evidence to that.
Related to the topic of COVID that we touched on a couple times already, I have read a couple of your articles, and you talked about the duty of healthcare workers to provide care in disaster situations. So I know the answer to this, but I would love to hear again what you think their duty is to respond and risk their own lives in these situations.
This goes back to Ebola. If you all remember when Ebola hit in 2014, 15 in West Africa, and then there were some cases in the US, including three nurses in Texas. There was a number of articles that came out that said, and they were both popular press articles, but also ethics journals and medical journals that said, you know, physicians have an absolute duty to treat, even if it's at risk to themselves. That's just, you know, handed down from God. It's like one of the Ten Commandments. And back then I was like, seriously, that sounds like utter BS to me. Where does that come from? And so I actually got together with a bunch of ethicists from Hopkins. I was faculty there, and they wrote an article with me that said the same thing, that we have a duty to treat. And you know, they gave all their arguments, and that pissed me off. And so I started doing a lot more reading on that. And then when COVID hit, the same kind of stuff came up. You know, oh, you have to risk your life. You have to go to work even if you could die. And I'm like, okay, fine, I'll die. I don't care. I'm old. But then I was like, but wait a minute, what happens if I bring COVID home and my wife gets it and she dies? She doesn't have a duty. Well, like, what the hell? Why do I have a duty to harm my family? Like, where does that come from? So I really started diving in and reading a lot of stuff about that. I went back to the original texts, including the 1851 state, 1851, I think it was a statement by the American Medical Association that says physicians have a duty to treat, because back then, you know, there was epidemics all the time and you had to take care of them. Someone had to take care of the patients. I went back and read Galen from the Roman times, who was a physician in the second century AD, who was the most physician alive then. And when Rome had an outbreak of the plague, he fled. And I read the whole history. There was a gentleman in 1947 who wrote a history of physicians responding to plagues over the centuries from the Roman times on. And for the most part, physicians left. And so there wasn't a lot of duty. And so I really started diving into it. And I found this whole lecture that they give us about, quote, duty to treat is utter crap. It's not true. It was one statement made by the AMA in 1851, and there's no other statement about that anywhere. And more importantly, though, this is only talking about physicians. There is no duty to treat. There is no requirement that nurses, or particularly the techs, all of our support staff, who again get paid minimum wage, you know, what is the duty for them to come to work and to die or to kill their families? And so I wrote an article that laid out, I think, very logically how it's utter crap that people say that, and there has to be another alternative. And so the argument goes from, okay, there's no duty to treat, we should all walk away. What is there a duty for? And the ethical principle is fairness. If you're telling me I have to risk my life, or you're telling a tech they have to risk their life, then they need to be compensated for that. You know, the military pays hazard duty pay, and engineering companies who explore in the African jungle pay hazard duty pay. Why don't healthcare workers get hazard duty pay? Why do healthcare workers, like at the beginning of the epidemic, a lot of us wouldn't go home. Some people rented their own apartments. Why do people who are risking their lives have to spend their money and their resources to protect their families? Why do we have to expose our families at all? Shouldn't our families get the vaccine first? Shouldn't they get Paxlovid first? Whatever. And so there's a reciprocity issue here that's way more important than duty to care. You are not going to get a minimum wage healthcare worker to come to work and risk their life if we have an epidemic that significantly kills people. COVID is a weeny little virus. It only killed, even before we had any treatments, 1 out of 200 people. And yet somewhere around 10,000 healthcare workers died. So let's say we have COVID that's stronger and more fatal and kills, I don't know, 1 out of 50 people. Our healthcare system will collapse unless we do something like hazard pay and compensation for people and their families for risking their lives and death compensation. In England during COVID, they actually gave £30,000 to healthcare workers who died. Didn't matter what they died for during COVID. If they died, then they got their £30,000. It was a no ask, no tell thing. In the US, OSHA took the stance of, well, we can't prove that the COVID infections were caused in the hospital, so screw the workers, and we're not even going to even track cases in the hospitals. And so in a future epidemic that has a more significant mortality, unless we choose some kind of fairness or reciprocity, our healthcare system will collapse. And frankly, that's what happened in Ebola in West Africa. All the healthcare systems collapsed because so many healthcare workers died. But Ebola has a 50% mortality rate, not a 0.5%.
That brings up a lot of questions for me. So one of them was, when I think about a profession like being a doctor and I compare that to something like a firefighter or a police officer, where I think you go into that job knowing that there is an inherent danger, should I be thinking of becoming a doctor as something that also has this inherent danger? Because I don't think a lot of med students or pre-med students think, oh, I'm going into a dangerous job when they pick that profession.
Yeah, that's one of the arguments that the ethicists use, is that we have a, you know, we have a known risk. And that's, again, utter crap. I mean, I'm sorry. No one in college, there's no risk in America to provide healthcare since we developed this magical thing called antibiotics. We don't have risk in the provision of healthcare. And so that presumed acceptance of risk is stupid. And in my paper, I argue against that because it's a ridiculous argument. There's no more danger in providing healthcare in America, except during COVID, than there is, like, you know, working in an office job. So,
and then the other thing was, I like that you touched on the graded responsibility of like, okay, well, these doctors have more of a responsibility than the nurses or the techs do. And it seems like that has just been established because in 1851, someone said, yes, you have a duty to do this, but no one said that for nurses, no one said that for techs. So is there anything else that that's based on?
Well, there is. Medical education for physicians is heavily subsidized by the federal government through Medicare and Medicaid payments. And so there is that argument that because our education is supplemented, then we have this duty to respond. You know, I find that to be a little bit ironic because even though our education is subsidized, most of that money just gets scooped up by the hospitals and they take it and they pay for our residency staff or whatever and their own, I don't know, lunchrooms. And, you know, the average medical school debt now coming out of medical school is over $200,000 for American medical graduates. So I find that argument to be a little bit ironic and stupid.
Yeah, me too.
the other argument is that we get paid a lot. And, you know, I agree with that. We get paid as American physicians. We're making double, triple, quadruple what a European physician doing the same job makes. And so there is an argument that because we're so heavily compensated, that we should be more willing to do that. And, you know, fine, I'm willing to do that. And even though I argue against this duty to treat, I'm more than happy to treat and take risks. I mean, I went to Liberia and Ebola. But to me, it's the family risk. Why should I be forced to risk my kids' lives? That, to me, that's just appalling and egregious. And there's no ethical argument. There's nothing. There has to be a way. If you want healthcare workers to work during an infectious disease event, that we 100% protect their families. And whether that's putting healthcare workers in dorms separately or paying for the families to fly to some magic island that's isolated, I don't care. There has to be something that we would never risk the lives of our loved ones. All the other arguments you can make about us having duty to risk as rich, well-compensated physicians don't apply to our families and don't apply to nurses and don't apply to the support staff.
You had mentioned rich, well-compensated physicians, but what about residents who are now
there you go
$200,000 in debt and they're working 80 hours a week and they're expected then to go and risk their lives. But honestly, they have like a negative salary. They get paid basically the same per hour as like working for fast food.
Yep. No, I agree. I mean, that residents are another issue. If you want to expect a resident, okay, you're going to do extra shifts in the ICU taking care of COVID patients for your next four rotations, then you know what? Yeah, they should be paid, I don't know, 10 grand more a month or 20 grand more a month. Or there should be a life insurance policy taken out by them in the hospital for $2 million to help pay for their family, whatever it is. Absolutely. You should compensate in pay for the risk, and you should compensate in insurance for death and injury, which occurs in so many other industries except ours. But, you know, that's because that's the other issue. So you're a resident, you're married, you have a small child, you die. And then what's going to happen to your kid? Who's going to pay for the kid for the next 25 years? You know, suddenly your income is gone. All that promise of your income is gone. That needs to be compensated for.
Yeah, I totally agree. So my hospital, I think, was a little strange. They actually did have hazard pay for nurses. All the nurses got hazard pay. All the techs got hazard pay. And then my program actually had to sue the hospital to get residents hazard pay. And it ended up being like $500 per person.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. So we felt very well compensated for our time and our efforts and our danger.
Well, the good news is you were at relatively low risk because mortality went up with age and comorbidities. But let's say that, you know, if you took the 1918 flu epidemic, which was a different bug, it killed young people. It, for the most part, because everyone believes hyper reactive immune response in younger people, the highest mortality in influenza in 1918 was in the 20s and 30-year-olds. And so, yeah, what happens when our next epidemic kills younger people? Then what's going to happen?
Yeah, and then I think they thought that that might happen when swine flu happened.
Yeah, the H1N1.
Yes, the H1N1. And everyone was really worried that we were going to have another 1918 flu on our hands.
Well, and, you know, it's a matter of time.
I mean, yeah, it is a matter of time. And these same topics are going to keep coming up unless there's a better solution. I agree, the healthcare system is going to crumble because why would I risk my life if it's not at least compensated?
Well, and you know, the first priority is to ensure the safety of your people.
Right.
And then, you know, that's the federal law from OSHA and stuff. And OSHA chose not to enforce federal law during COVID, even though it's law. And no one pulled them to task for that. But early on, you know, we all went through the, oh, go ahead, just reuse your mask for the next 3 years. Surgical masks were fine. Don't worry about it. It's not aerosolized. And all that utter crap where they're feeding us that we all knew was lies. And, you know, they didn't have a choice because we didn't have the supplies. That's unacceptable.
Yeah.
You know, forcing people to have increased risk because of the incompetency of the administrative state, whether it's governmental or private sector from the hospitals, is completely unacceptable and will guarantee in the future, if we don't have sufficient masks and supplies and everything stockpiled we need, it will guarantee the collapse of the healthcare system. Because when people start seeing their colleagues die, they're going to walk away. That's what happened in West Africa. And that's what's going to happen here if we have a disease that's not, again, a weaning little virus like COVID. COVID was nothing, killed, you know, 1 million, 2 Americans, but it's a stupid little virus.
Yeah, I remember reusing my N95 for like 2 months. I feel like I should have dipped it in gold and like framed it because I had that thing for so long.
Already dipped in mucus and sweat. So.
Yeah, the gold wouldn't even stick to it. It's too disgusting. We've thought a lot about COVID, but do you know if there are differences in nurses and doctors' willingness to participate in something like the COVID pandemic versus a more acute disaster like an earthquake? Are people more willing to jump in and help with that, even though there is still some risk versus a long, prolonged pandemic like COVID?
Yeah, there's been a number of surveys, a dozen, that look at, quote, willingness to respond. If you type in willingness to respond in a PubMed search, you'll find a bunch. And they ask specific questions, you know, would you reply to an earthquake and would you reply to this and that? And always uniformly, an infectious disease event gets the worst response rate. And depending on the surveys, some in Europe, most in the US, as many as 25% of the people say they will not respond to an infectious disease event. And radiation event, because there's some risk of carrying that home, is also one that has a little bit less of a response rate. But, you know, responding to an earthquake, it's a pain in the butt sleeping in a tent, eating K rations, but it's not really a risk thing. And so the willingness of healthcare workers to respond to those events is huge. I mean, every event I went to, there were more healthcare workers who showed up to help than were scheduled to work, except for the infectious disease events.
I don't know if this is related to it, but you can kind of see what's going on with an earthquake, but, you know, a pandemic's invisible. You can't really see when you're infected or when you're about to get infected. So I don't know, maybe that has something to do with your willingness to participate.
I mean, I think the main thing, an earthquake occurs, there's aftershocks, but there's one event and then it kills a bunch of people, injures a bunch of people. And then except for aftershocks, there's no other risk involved with COVID or with an infectious disease. Every time you set foot in a hospital, you have risk every time. And if you stay at home with your family, isolated, then you don't have any risk.
If this were to happen again, we had mentioned some of the things that should be considered to help keep healthcare workers actually in the system, other than like compensation and insurance and safety for families. Is there anything else that you would suggest that a hospital or healthcare system implement to keep people around?
One of the interesting thing in the willingness to respond surveys is that in a couple of them, they ask, you know, what's most likely to keep you around. And one of the most important predictors of people staying on the job is that their colleagues and friends are still working. And so in my one article in the Washington Post, I talked about the drip, drip, drip of attrition. And when you see people not coming to work, it makes you less likely to work. When you see your colleagues getting sick and hospitalized, it makes you less likely to work. And so there is a big camaraderie thing. You know, it's not unlike the military where you have a platoon. We all work together. We're all there to help. We're all there for each other in the emergency department. And so that is something that has to be preserved. I don't know how you would do that other than to protect your healthcare workers so they don't quit. But that's a big mental thing for all healthcare workers.
In residency, obviously, none of us felt like we had a choice. It was we were going to show up. But a lot of the attendings, like anyone who was anywhere near retirement age, was like, okay, it's time. And a lot of them ended up retiring. And I feel like that's going to happen again.
Frankly, that's a rational decision because if you're near retirement age, your mortality risk is 25 times greater than what yours was as a resident. So, duh.
That's true.
Although I was too stupid to quit, but I wasn't working many shifts because I had a full-time federal job. So I only had a few shifts a month to worry about.
So you had responded to Ebola. How did that response compare to what you experienced during COVID? Was it a similar state of fear or was it higher?
So I wasn't one of the brave responders who provided clinical care strapped in their rubber gowns and clothes and gloves. I responded as an epidemiologist, and I was doing work on disease reporting and case tracking. But the country going into Ebola, going into West Africa, literally I arrived like a few days before the peak number of cases. And at that time, that was hundreds of people dying a day in Monrovia. The fear in the country was palpable. Everywhere you went, everything you did, every breath you took, there was fear involved. Every building had buckets of bleach water out front. You had to wash your hands coming and going. Some people wore masks, but for the most part, they knew that masks didn't really help. It wasn't a risk for disease. You never shook hands. You could always tell the newbies like me, you show up and you're like, "Hey, I'm Tom," and you try to shake hands, and people like want to run away from you. You never touched anyone. You never sat near anyone. You never, if you went to a restaurant, because you had to eat somewhere as a foreigner, the few restaurants that were open were in the hotels. The servers wore gloves and you had hand sanitizing at your table. You could wipe your hands and wash your hands and wipe off your own silverware. The fear and anxiety was just overwhelming. It was a very, very strange experience. And it's a very strange experience to have absolutely zero human contact for months, no hugs or no handshakes or no patting on the back, nothing. We'd bump elbows. That was the thing. You bump elbows. So yeah, it was pretty bizarre.
If there were to be something similar to an outbreak of Ebola here in the US, how do you think the healthcare workforce and the healthcare system would hold up to that?
Well, Ebola, because it's contact spread, is much more manageable from the perspective of infection control. I don't know if you remember, but when the guy came back from Liberia and Texas, and then three of his nurses were infected, they all lived, luckily. It was just utter panic across the country in the healthcare setting. But the politicians, closed the borders, and all the idiots were saying stupid stuff. So it's manageable, and we have a plan, and we have Ebola units. There's a few hospitals designated now across the country, University of Nebraska Medical Center, Grady Hospital, some others that have Ebola containment units. And so the initial plan is to triage patients there, and they have a much higher level of care. But even if it goes a little bit beyond that, I think it's easier to manage. I do, however, think, because even with treatment, there's an Ebola vaccine now, which is pretty useful, and there's some other treatments. But even with treatment, your mortality rate would be 20 plus percent, but the transmission rate is much lower. But it would be essential that we paid people hazard pay. Absolutely no question. If you're going to go work in an Ebola unit, you should get an extra $1,000 a day or whatever the number is, or it won't work at all. The first group of people to die in Liberia were, it would sweep through families and it would kill mothers in particular because they cared for their sick children. And then they passed it on to their other children and their husband. And so it'd kill whole families. And then it killed people who attended funerals because a number of the cultures in West Africa have a ritual of ritually cleaning the dead as a group and stuff. And so it killed, swept through them. And then the next group of people killed as healthcare workers, particularly nurses, because it's nurses who are the ones who clean up the vomit and the poop and all the other stuff. And all that's infectious. And so when the nurses started dying, the other nurses and techs and doctors walked away. And they had no infection control. They're lucky if they had gloves at that time. So it's really imperative to have absolute infection control and some kind of compensation.
Do you think that because it is a little bit harder to spread, well, much harder to spread than COVID, that it would be quite a bit harder to actually get a large scale outbreak like West Africa?
Dying of Ebola is pretty dramatic. And so it's easy to diagnose early and therefore prevent widespread spread. COVID is the opposite. It's like the cold, the flu or having a common cold. So it's harder to recognize. Ebola is not indigenous to the US. And so there's always, knock on wood so far, there's always going to be a warning because there has to be an outbreak in Africa. But there's other illnesses out there, other hemorrhagic fevers and other potential illnesses that are not as fatal but much easier transmitted, and those are the big issues.
How would you recommend, just to like kind of finish this off, that healthcare workers or responders take care of themselves in these kind of situations?
The biggest thing is to not ignore it, but to acknowledge it. And whether you choose to hang out with your colleagues and talk about it, or you choose to read scientific papers about PTSD, or you want to see a therapist, or whatever your method of caring for yourself, you have to do that. You know, I like to go out into the wilderness by myself for a week or so and recover. And everyone has to have their different method. But I think after COVID and after all the studies that show the stress and the mortality of healthcare workers, there's a much bigger awareness of that now. And so I hope people are more open to self-care and to self-protection to prevent, you know, these outcomes again. And this is going to happen again. It's infectious diseases ain't going away. And with climate change, the probability of them of new infectious diseases arising or mutating or transmission at different levels or into different geographic areas is increasing. And so we have to be aware of that. And the other thing I think that's important is we have to think about these things in advance. How will I make decisions in a resource-constrained environment? What's best for me to do that? Some people are just willing to make decisions. Other people have to hand it off. What will I do to protect my family in these events? What would be our plan to do that? What would it mean to me in regard to, you know, working 80 extra hours or whatever in regard to stress and other things? What am I going to do to deal with these things? So all of us, I believe, have to have a, you know, not a formal personal plan, but at least have reflected on these issues and the potential impact on us and our families.
Music track courtesy of Pixabay and composed by Alex Zavesa. I'm your host, Larissa Unruh, and I'll see you next time on The Disaster Project. Want more learning? Check out the content at Urgent Matters for e-newsletters, webinars, tools, conferences, and podcasts to enhance your practice. Whatever your practice might be, go to urgentmatters.smhs.gwu.edu. Have an idea for a topic to discuss, or know someone that you think would be great to interview on The Disaster Project? Send us a message about it. Email thedisasterprojectpodcast@gmail.com to let us know your thoughts, ideas, and suggestions. Can't wait to read them.